This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, man, if things aren't laying themselves in front of you, out in front of you, the way that is necessary for you to live a full and engaged life and not be cynical and bitter and twisted and cruel and vengeful and disappointed and all of that, it's just possible that you're not aiming at the right thing. And man, that is a question worth asking. Well, it's the question people do ask. It's like, well, what's the purpose of life? Well, it's the same question. What should I aim at? Those are the same questions. And, you know, if what you're aiming at is producing nothing but unrequited misery for you and everyone else, and it's a downhill bloody spiral into something approximating hell, then there is some possibility that you should think that perhaps your aim is off. So, and I don't want to overplay my hand on that either, too, because I know perfectly well that, you know, if you're suffering, if you're depressed, if you're miserable, it might be a consequence of really bad luck. You know, like, people get sick. And good people get sick, right? Everyone knows that. You know, good people, they get sick and they die. And so you can't say, well, if you're miserable and sick, it's because there's something, you know, bad about you. Because then that would be the case for everyone. Always, whenever they get ill, and you could just blame ill people. It's like, well, it serves you right that you're sick because you're a bad person. It happens a lot, actually, with ill people, you know, and it's an unfortunate thing. So I know there's an element of chance to all this, and I don't want to downplay that. You know, we are dust in the wind, to use a terrible cliche from a 70s rock song. We're blown hither and thither by events that are somewhat beyond our control, but that's still not the point. The point is that to a large degree, you can determine the manner in which the world manifests itself to you by changing your aim. And so then that opens up the entire domain of philosophy. You think, what good is philosophy? And people think that all the time. What good is philosophy? It's like, hey, philosophy is about value. Well, what use is value? Well, value determines your aim. Well, who cares what your aim is? Well, your aim determines the manner in which the world lays itself out to you emotionally. Well, who cares about that? No one says that. The argument stops there because no one, especially no one who's been seriously hurt or seriously depressed, like in pain, no one ever says, oh, well, who cares about that? Because if you can say that about your pain, all that means is you actually haven't been in pain. Because if you're in enough pain, you will not say that, that's for sure. So you need to know what to aim at. So now you aim at something, you've got a goal, and then you see that you're making progress towards the goal. That's a good thing. That makes you happy. It actually, technically, there's a system, dopamine system, neurochemical system, same system, by the way, that cocaine and methamphetamine and opiates activate, which is why people like to take those drugs. And it tells you that you're moving forward in the manner that you should be according to the dictates of your plan. Doesn't necessarily tell you whether you have a good plan. That's a more complicated problem, because who knows if you have a good plan. But one thing that you could know is that a plan is better than no plan. That's a really useful thing to know, especially if you're kind of drifting. It's like, well, I'm going to find myself. It's like, no, just pick something and move towards it. And as you move towards it, you're going to succeed and fail specifically. And then you're going to learn something about success specifically. And you're going to learn something about failure specifically. And then you can learn what you use to fix your plan. So a stupid plan is way better than no plan. And you're likely to have a stupid plan, or at least to be able to make one. So that's good news for everybody. You can make a stupid plan. And so I would say, make a stupid plan. And then implement it. Not any stupider than it has to be. You know, you could think about it a little bit. But then implement it. And have your successes and failures along the way. And learn from them. And then you can rejig the goal. You can move the target. That's fine. That's part of the game. It doesn't have to be fixed. It's a movable target. And maybe what you're trying to do is to move the target to an ever better place. So you're moving towards a target, and at the same time, you're moving the target, right? And you're trying to move the target towards something like an ultimate ideal. You're trying to find out what that ultimate ideal is, and part of the way you figure that out is by moving towards a target and by learning about success and failure along the way, because then you can inform yourself with regards to what might constitute a reasonable aim. And so that's the reason to go out in the world and like make some mistakes, you know? And then you're going to, and so it's okay. It's okay to make the mistakes. It's not so okay not to learn from them, because then you make the mistakes again. That seems pointless. And so you're moving towards wherever you're going, and it's working. And so you get some positive emotion. You get some motivation from this dopaminergic system that adds zest to life. It adds interest and engagement and meaning to life. It pulls you into life. And that's worth thinking about, I would say, because if you think about it, you know, you might wonder about whether or not you should be engaged in life. And then if all of a sudden you're doing something, and because you're doing it, you get engaged in life, then it seems like that might be the very definition of a good thing. It's evidence. The engagement is evidence that you're actually doing a good thing, a worthwhile thing in life with all its suffering and misery and brutality. It's like you've got a pathway, you've got an aim, you're moving forward, you're engaged. Excellent. Your nervous system, very deep down, this dopaminergic system, it's associated with a part of the brain called the hypothalamus. It's a really, really old part of the brain. It's not some new thing that popped up like 15,000 years ago. It's ancient. It's there to orient you in the world. It's part of the instinct for meaning that I talked about in chapter, I think it's chapter 7, do what is meaningful and not what is expedient. It's a deep, deep instinct. And way down in your psychophysiological structure, not as far down as the serotonin system, but like next level up. And so if it's saying, hey man, you're on the right track, it's like, that's worth noticing. It's worth noticing. Now you can criticize it out of existence. You can question your aim continually. It's one of the, what would you call it, dangers of our capacity to abstract. But you know, if you're a smart person who doubts, you also might be smart enough now and then to doubt your doubt and just to notice and to pay attention. And not only that, it's what you need to do, because you need to have a meaning in your life, an aim, a value structure that's of sufficient potency and magnitude to justify the limitations and the trouble that life constitutes, right? This is no trivial business that we're involved in, right? We're all in this up to our necks, literally. It's a mortal game. You're all in. And to play it wrong is to risk suffering and hell. And I'm not talking about afterlife. I'm not talking about something metaphysical. You can generate plenty of hell right here around you. Plenty. An unlimited amount. And so you can move towards that direction, or you can move towards a positive direction. And you can orient yourself. And you can learn. This is why the postmodernists are so incorrect. It's like, look, you need an aim. You need an aim. You cannot organize the way you look at the world without an aim. It's not optional. And then the question is, well, what should the aim be? Well, probably not to radically increase the amount of misery and suffering that you experience in everyone else. I mean, maybe you want to go that route, but... And people do, but I think they only do when they become bitter and they give up, you know? They make mistakes they know they're making, right? It's conscious decision to go down that route. It's not like they think that's okay to begin with. Their aim's wrong. It's like, straighten out your aim. So there's an old idea, this idea of sin. Sin is a word that was derived from a Greek word, hamartia. And hamartia is an archery term, and it means to miss the target. And so you think, well, how can you miss the target? Well, you have no weapon. Well, then you miss the target. You have no target. You have no aim. Well, then you miss the target. You don't pick up your bow. Well, then you miss the target. You don't draw it back. Then you miss the target. You don't practice and miss many times, right? Because you have to do that to develop the skill to hit the target. So you're not willing to take the risk to miss. You do none of that. And so you miss the target. And that's the sin. And then you miss your life. And then what happens around you is that, well, there's far more hell than there has to be, and there's much less heaven than there could be, and it's on you.
That's, now, for me, the most important question in life is not what the world is made of. And in fact, I would say that's a relatively new preoccupation of humankind. You know, we didn't really formalize, you could say that the ancient Greeks originated, laid the groundwork for the emergence of an empirical science. And then it emerged more formally with Bacon and Descartes and Newton 500-600 years ago. Not very long, like a blink of the eye in human terms. Before that, people were engineers, they could build things and so forth, but they didn't know how to, they weren't scientists. They didn't really conceptualize the world as an objective place. We do that automatically because science has seeped so far into our set of presuppositions. That doesn't make us good scientists, by the way, but it does make us believe that the fundamental reality of the world is an objective reality. And I'm not going to dispute that particularly, but leaves one set of questions unanswered, probably by its nature, because it wasn't designed to answer the question, and that question is, how should one conduct oneself in the world? And that's an important thing, since you're alive, and hypothetically you'd rather stay alive, and while you're alive you probably don't want to suffer any more than you have to, and no more stupidly than you have to, and it might also be good if some of the things that you wanted actually happened, and so, you know, you're motivated to know how to act, and people are always telling each other how to act. We're sending each other information all the time about how to act. We do that with the expressions on our face, and of course when we talk to people we always look at their face, and that's because their face tells you what they're up to. You know, if they're smiling and paying attention to you, well then you can assume that you're doing something right. And if they're looking annoyed or disgusted, that's a particularly bad one, then you might think, you might take a hint from that, especially if, you know, three or four people are doing it at the same time. And so we're reflecting some ideal to one another constantly. And the more attentive you are, the more likely you are to act in accordance with that ideal, and the more likely you are to move towards it. You may not even know what the ideal is in an articulated sense. In fact, you probably don't. You know, you could come up with a good person is nice and friendly and, you know, cooperative, and yeah, you know, that's all just cliche. But you don't, you know, your conception might be very hollow. It's very likely that it's very hollow, even though you may be able to act in a very sophisticated manner.
I've been reading this book recently. I'll talk about it a little bit later. It's called Better Never to Have Been. And it was written by a philosopher in South Africa, in Cape Town, named Benatar. That's his last name. And he basically argues, I think it's a specious argument, and I think it's artificially constructed. But he basically argues that
this isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Because life is so full of suffering, even good lives are very much full of suffering, that it's wrong to bring children into the world because the suffering outweighs the good, even in good lives. And it's actually wrong. It would also be better not to exist for exactly the same reason. And my sense in reading the book is that he came to that conclusion and then wrote the book to justify it, which is actually the reverse of the way that you should write a book. What you should do when you're writing a book is you should have a question, and it should be a real question, right? It should be one you don't know the answer to. And then you should be studying and writing like mad and reading everything you can get your hands on to see if you can actually grapple with the problem and come to some solution. And you should walk the reader as well through your process of thinking so that they can come to the, well, not necessarily to the same conclusion, but at least track what you're doing. And I don't think that's what he did. I think he wrote it backwards. But then, so I was thinking about it a lot, because that's actually a question that I've contended with in my writing. There are Mephistophelian or satanic figures, for example, in Goethe's Faust, and also Ivan in the Brothers Karamazov, who basically make the same case, you know, that existence is so rife with trouble and suffering that it would be better if it didn't exist at all. And the problem I've had with that, there's a variety of them, but one of the problems I've had with that is what happens if you start to think that way, because what I've observed is that people who begin to think that way, that isn't where they stop. Like, they get angry at existence, which is what happened to Cain, as we saw in the Cain and Abel story, and then the next step is to start taking revenge against existence, and that cascades until it's revenge against, well, I think the best way of thinking about it is revenge against God for the crime of being, which is, I think, the deepest sort of hatred that you can entertain. And when you're in the grip of a really deep emotion, like a really profound emotion, right at the bottom of emotions, you're in something that's like a quasi-religious state, and that's more or less independent of your belief, say, in a transcendent deity. I mean, you can be in a profoundly emotional state that's as deep as it can be, and it can have religious significance without that necessarily signifying anything about a transcendent being, you know. But then I was thinking, see, the problem with that argument is you can gerrymander it endlessly, you know, because first of all, how do you measure suffering and how do you measure happiness? It's like, how do you assign weights to them? And God, there's just no way of doing that. You have to do it arbitrarily. And so you can make an argument that the suffering outweighs the happiness. You just weight the suffering more heavily than you weight the happiness, and that's the end of that, you know? And so that's a problem. But I think there's a deeper problem. And I was reading this other book a while back as well, which was written by the guy who ran the Human Genome Project, and I don't remember exactly what it was called, but it was something like A Scientist's Case for God, or something like that. And one of the things he referred to, which didn't strike me as hard as it should have to begin with, was he thought that one of the phenomena, say, that justified a belief in a transcendent being was something like the moral intuition of human beings, that, you know, we have a sense of right and wrong, and you know, it's certainly what happens in Genesis in the story of Adam and Eve is that story announces the coming of the sense of right and wrong, right? The knowledge of good and evil. And it isn't something we ascribe to animals. It's something that's unique to human beings. Animals can be predators and, you know, and they can be gentle and you can have a relationship with them, but you never think of an evil cat or, you know, or an evil wolf, even though they're, you know, they're predatory. But human beings, we have this capacity to judge between good and evil, right and wrong. And it's really an integral part of our being. And I think you can make an evolutionary case for that, a biological case for that, as you can make a biological case for most of what is relevant about human beings because we're biological creatures. But we don't really understand the significance of that. Like, what happens in the story of Adam and Eve is that's that realization, that coming to the knowledge of good and evil, is actually represented as a shift of cosmic significance, right? It puts a permanent fracture in the structure of being. And, you know, if you think of human beings as insignificant ants on a tiny dust mote in the middle of an infinite cosmos, a cosmos that cares less for us, then who cares fundamentally if human beings have the knowledge to distinguish between good and evil. But if you give consciousness a central role in being, and you can make a perfectly reasonable case for that, because without consciousness there's no being, as far as anyone can determine, so it may be much more central than we think. And I really don't think there's a counter-argument to that. Like, not a solid one. You can state that consciousness is epiphenomenal and that the world is fundamentally materialistic and it doesn't matter that there's consciousness. You can state that, but you can make an equally credible case the other way. And certainly our lived experience is that consciousness is crucial, obviously, and we treat each other as if most of the time we're valuable conscious beings, and we wouldn't give up our consciousness, even though it's often consciousness of suffering. And so then I think another problem with the book is that it's sort of predicated on the idea that life is for happiness. And I don't think that's right, and I don't think that's how people experience life, and I might be wrong, but it seems to me that people experience life as something like a series of crucial ethical decisions. It's something like that. I mean, when I just can't imagine, and maybe I'm being naive about this, but I can't imagine another being that's like me in most senses that isn't constantly wrestling in some sense with what the next proper thing to do is. It's not like it's obvious. It's not bloody obvious. And it doesn't mean you'll do the right thing, because you don't lots of times. And you know that by your own judgment, right? Because you're making mistakes all the time. Sometimes you don't know what you're doing, and maybe it's a mistake, and maybe it isn't. And who's to say? But that isn't what I'm talking about. I'm talking about when you know that what you're doing is wrong, and you go ahead and do it anyways. People do that all the time. And that's also extremely peculiar. You bloody well think that if you knew it was wrong, and you told yourself that it was wrong, that would be sufficient, so that you just wouldn't do it. But that isn't what you're like at all, you know. And you can tell yourself something is wrong 50 times, and you'll do it the 51st time, and then you'll feel, you know, like you deserve to feel, probably. But it doesn't stop you. And so then I think the other problem with the viewpoint, the idea that the suffering of life eradicates its utility, is that it's predicated on the idea that happiness or lack of suffering even is the right criteria by which to judge life. And I don't think that's how we actually experience life. I think what we do instead is put ourselves through a series of excruciating moral choices. You know, and one of the things that's really significant about the biblical stories, and I think about the entire implicit philosophy, you know, that's embedded in the stories, is that that's how life is presented in the stories, is all of these individuals, first they're individuals, they're not groups, and second, they're agonizing over their moral choices all the time. And they have a relationship with God, but it's not a directive relationship exactly. Even the people to whom God speaks directly, which I suspect is not something you'd exactly want to have happen, they're still, even the fact that they have a direct relationship with God doesn't stop them from being tormented continually by their moral choices. And so the world is presented as a moral landscape, not as a place that justifies itself by happiness. It's presented as a moral landscape, and people are presented as creatures who traverse through the moral landscape, making ethical decisions that determine the course of the world. And that seems to me to be right. And that's not the same as happiness by any stretch of the imagination. It's a whole different category of being. And, you know, and then I've thought that through a lot. And I think, well, we do make choices. And what we do is contend with the future, you know. And the future seems to appear to us as a realm of possibility. That's a more accurate way of thinking about it than that the future presents itself to us as a realm of determined things. It presents itself as a realm of possibility, and there's good choices in that realm, and there's poor choices or even evil choices in that realm, and we're negotiating continually, deciding which of those choices we're going to bring into being. That seems to me to be phenomenologically indisputable, and we certainly treat each other as if that's what we're doing, because we hold each other responsible for our actions, you know, with some exceptions, and that we're deciding each moment whether to make things better or worse. And
That seems to me to be correct. And there's a profound anti-human ethos, I think, that pervades our culture, you know, that considers human beings cancers on the planet, something like that, you know, and that there should be less of us. It's the same spirit that motivated the guy who wrote the book about it better to have never been. And it's like, I don't see it that way, you know. I mean, I think people do pretty well for, you know, for having their leg caught in a bear trap and their head caught in a vice. They're actually doing pretty well, because life is really hard, and the fact that we're not absolutely brutal and murderous all the time is really something remarkable, given what we actually have to contend with, that we can go out of our way to be honest and generous and altruistic and to care for each other under unbelievably dire circumstances, and to act nobly sometimes under the most trying conditions. You know, in Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, he tells story after story of people who acted abysmally, but also people who, under the worst threats imaginable, never sacrificed their character. You know, and reading about that is really, well, it really makes you wonder. That's what it does. Now, video games are, okay, so the question is, can that sense of meaning be hijacked? And the answer to that is absolutely, absolutely. Because you could say that the ultimate sense of meaning is composed of the union of fragmentary senses of meaning, and the fragmentary senses of meaning can be overwhelmingly powerful. Anger, sexual lust, and the sorts of things that you experience when, say, when you're playing a video game, which are very carefully calibrated to keep you on the edge of exploration, let's say. Now, I'm not a foe of video games, because games are complicated and it isn't clear what people are doing when they're playing them. You know, they may be expanding their cognitive skills. They may be learning to cooperate. They may be learning to engage in complex problem solving. And so, but part of it's also a matter of balance, you know. 50 hours a week, probably not, unless you're going to go pro, right? Because there's other things you need to be attending to. It's not a stable solution for you, your family, your society. It's too one-sided. Yeah, and you can get pulled down rabbit holes of all sorts that are one-sided pursuits of meaning. So, and it's something we're actually going to talk about as the later classes unfold. The question is, how do you stop yourself from falling prey to a pathologized sense of meaning? And I think one of the answers to that is, don't lie. Because what you're hoping is that your nervous system is sufficiently healthy and well programmed so that what it reads out to you is reliable. And if you pathologize your psyche by either through sins of omission, let's say, or outright deception, you're going to warp that internal structure and it's not going to read out properly to you. And then your sense of meaning will lead you astray. So, like, one of the reasons for speaking the truth, I shouldn't say that, because you don't know how to speak the truth, but you do know how not to lie. And it's a game you're playing with yourself. You can define the damn lies. No one else has to do that for you. You try not to utter falsehoods, because you warp your neurological structure by doing so, and then it will read out pathologically. And then if you rely on it to guide you, it will run you right off a cliff. So that's why there's a moral element to this, is if you're going to rely on your sense of meaning, make sure that you don't pollute the mechanism.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.